Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm joined by my co-host Adrian Bloom, editorial director of the magazine, and Bob Ferguson, president of Strategic Consulting. And I think we're ready.
We're ready now.
I think we're ready now.
You're rolling, though.
We're rolling. You guys don't know it, but there's been a little bit to get here, so... But we're here, and we're happy to be here, and we're happy that you're here. That's the most important part. So thank you all for joining us. And for today's interview, we've got an incredible panel of experts, including Dr. Vanessa Kaufman, director of the Alliance to Stop Foodborne Illness, and two of its members, Sherry Bryce Williamson, Vice President of Global Food Safety and Quality at the Kellogg Company, and Megan Kanjora, Senior Manager of Food Safety Culture at the Hershey Company. They're here to discuss how the Alliance is working to support the industry, specifically small to medium-sized companies, in creating their food safety culture journeys with effective and free tools. You'll hear them speak to this, but I have to say that this really exemplifies not just the spirit, but the application of the statement that we hear so often, food safety is not a competitive advantage.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we had a really riveting conversation about food safety culture and best practices, corporate responsibility, and, you know, how these companies are using the free tools offered by STOP to optimize culture within their organizations. So we're really looking forward to bringing that interview to you today.
Okay, so... don't touch that dial. You'll hear that interview right after the news, which starts now.
Right now. So one exciting thing that we're looking forward to next year is the release of a new edition of Poisoned, which is the novel by Jeff Benedict that chronicles the story of the 1993 Jack in the Box outbreak, along with the release of a Netflix documentary in January that's based on the book. Now, as many of you know, one of the central figures of that book is attorney Bill Marler, who represented Breanne Kiner, the most seriously injured survivor of the outbreak, as well as hundreds of other victims in a class action suit. Now, Bill Marler got his start with the Jack in the Box case, and he's now a prominent food safety attorney, having represented victims of nearly every large foodborne illness outbreak in the U.S. for the past 26 years. We also had the chance to talk with Bill on the podcast, where he tells his story of the 1993 outbreak, as well as his outlook on the future of food safety legislation in the U.S. So make sure to look back at that episode, and we'll put the link in the show notes for you.
That's episode 128, just in case.
Yeah, thanks, Stacey. So as we understand, this Netflix documentary is going to explore untold stories from the victims of foodborne illness outbreaks and detail subsequent criminal prosecutions. It'll also look at the history of food safety in the U.S., much of which was spurred by the 1993 outbreak. You know, it was actually Jack in the Box that prompted USDA to address the problem of E. coli in ground beef by declaring it as an adulterant. So I think you'll be seeing and hearing some familiar faces and voices from our podcast during this documentary. So keep an eye out for that in January.
Well, that's really interesting, the part about the fact that they're going to kind of delve into other things beyond, you know, the Jack in the Box outbreak. Because when I think of Poisoned and I think of this whole time, I always think of Dave Thino. So, you know, I know a lot of people associate this with Bill and lawsuits and Bill Marler, as well as other personal injury lawyers out there. They're stakeholders. It's just, you can't hate the players. They're just players in this game. And so they're stakeholders in this market. But I always think of Thino and the fact, too, that Bill and Dave wound up having a lifelong friendship as a result of it. And we're talking to Stop Foodborne Illness. Just the other day, they posted something on LinkedIn about the fact that it would have been Dave Thino's 71st birthday the other day. And just reading the amount of the comments and things that people said about him, we talk about culture, and Bill said it in his interview that that really Dave, in so many ways, made culture out of whole cloth. You know, the way he approached food safety, the way he approached the non-competitive nature of food safety. And people in their comments on LinkedIn were sort of alluding to that, too. It's like somebody called, Hal King talked about, he called Bill to ask him a question, and he had him out. He's like, you know, how are you dealing with this? And so he invited him out, and he showed him everything that Jack in the Box was doing. So, you know, sometimes you hear things, oh, it's not competitive. Well, in food safety, it really is, and many, many times. So if you're not experiencing this directly, it's real in food safety. You know, become a part of the community if you're not already, and know that everybody's here to support one another and to share information, which people do beyond competitive lines. You know, is putting out a safe product competitive advantage? Yeah. Sure, against somebody who's not. But at the end of the day, everybody in this industry is working together across competitive lines to ensure public health. So, amen.
Absolutely. It's exciting to see that there's going to be a Netflix documentary. And everything you just said about what's been built on food safety since 1993 shouldn't be overlooked. So I hope that the Netflix documentary is positive.
Yeah.
You know, there's not very much positive to talk about with the outbreak, of course. That was a tragedy. But as far as what happened since then and what is going on now, I would hate for someone to be looking at Netflix and think that what happened in 1993 has anything to do with the state of their food today and miss all the things that you just discussed about what's been built. So let's hope that they address that and not scare people about what's happening in 2022.
And at the same time, I think that it's good for people to be aware, right? Because we know that the last link in the chain is customer behavior, right? Is consumer behavior, right? They're stakeholders too. So it's important that they understand, you know, the risks involved,
right,
as well.
Right. Absolutely.
Thanks for letting me preach.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, longtime listeners of the podcast will remember that the very first episode of this podcast was conducted, in fact, with Dave Theno way back in May of 2017. The title of that was No One Cooks Their Salad. So we appreciate the fact that we got to have Dave Theno on the podcast to introduce this podcast and, you know, of course, to have that for all time.
I say it all the time. We miss him so much. I know everybody in the industry does. So
absolutely. Yeah. So next in our news lineup, we also have an update for you, and I know a lot of you have been very interested in following this story, on the FDA's final traceability rule, which is part of FSMA Section 204, and which establishes additional traceability record-keeping requirements for certain foods that are listed on the food traceability list. Now, this list was created using a risk ranking model, and it includes things such as non-hard cheeses, shell eggs, nut butter, a number of whole and fresh cut vegetables, leafy greens, herbs, and fruits, fin fish, shellfish, and ready to eat deli salads. So FDA issued the final rule, which is officially titled Requirements for Additional Traceability Records for Certain Foods, on November 15th. And as of the time of this recording, it's anticipated to be published in the Federal Register on November 21st. Now, although the proposed requirements would technically apply only to the foods on this traceability list, they're designed to be suitable for all FDA food products, and FDA will encourage the voluntary adoption of these practices industry-wide. Now, the traceability rule will require food manufacturers, processors, packers, and holders to create and maintain records with key data elements associated with critical tracking events along the processing and supply chains. The rule is focused on biological hazards and chemical toxins that present an immediate public health risk and for which traceability would be necessary to quickly identify the source of contamination and to prevent additional illnesses. Now, FDA plans to periodically review this list to assess if updates to the foods list or to other elements of the rule are appropriate. The FDA set up a traceability rule webpage and that has extensive explanations and clarifications for all manners of growers, processors, packers, and others involved with the supply chain. So make sure to check out the link to that page in the show notes to find out more information. And speaking of getting more information, we also want to remind you that you can still register for our traceability webinar with speakers from FDA and industry on November 29th. We think you'll find this webinar especially informative since we'll be speaking with FDA's traceability team lead and rule writing team lead, as well as, of course, Frank Yannis, along with representatives from IFPA and GS1 to share an industry perspective on the practical implementation and value of traceability initiatives. So don't forget to check the show notes and register for that webinar, again, taking place on November 29th at 2 p.m. Eastern.
We'll be there. We're very excited. I'm sure you guys have noticed that we're pretty excited about this one.
It's pretty timely. It's going to be a good timing.
This is a lot. This has been a long time coming. And I guess, Adrian, as you were reading that, the list of, you know, who this impacts, the list was food manufacturers, processors, packers, and holders. I was waiting to hear retailers and restaurants, but I guess technically they fall under that holders category. So just for clarification.
Well, Stacy, you're saying that there's going to be a lot of impact. The rule is only 597 pages, so I don't know why you think there's a lot behind this.
You know, and I finished reading it. I did.
Did you? Did you get the whole thing done?
Yeah, I got it. I got it.
There's a lot in here. I'll make two quick comments. One is the FDA recognizes in the rule that the transition to compliance of the rule really depends upon making sure the rule is fully understood, and the type of tools that people are going to need to track their supply chain this way aren't really going to be available until that understanding is there. So things like the webinar coming up to be able to understand exactly what's required, what this means, what happens if you have an FDA compliant supplier, but you're not necessarily regulated by the FDA, how does that interchange? So when they say that voluntary compliance, it seems to me at least that it's almost going to be difficult for most people, particularly some of the international suppliers, to not comply with this in some way. So, and the amount of traceability and be able to produce results in 24 hours is remarkable. So I don't think most people have that ability, but we'll see.
Mm. And yeah, there was another scenario that I read too. Well, what if you come under the rule, but one of your suppliers doesn't?
Right.
Right? Is exempt. This is going to take a long time. And there's a 3-year, you know, ramp here to right. Get everybody up to speed. And I kind of stopped and had to read very carefully. One of the things it said is that it will go into effect in January 2023, but it will... What's the right word?
Require compliance.
Yeah, compliance will be in effect January 2026. So right. I think a lot of these questions are going to be answered over time. And it's definitely going to take some time to get it all in place.
To give you an idea of the complexity, in the last Insights article, we were talking about compliance with FSMA, and the international suppliers were still saying they're working on their compliance with the original FSMA requirements. So this is going to be an additional thing that they need to comply with. The other thing I'll mention is, as soon as this was published, FMI came out and had a statement on this that sounds like they're challenging the FDA on this. And I'll just say a couple of things they say. It says, it looks like this rule significantly exceeds the statutory authority, both written and intended by Congress. And then they list some of the goals of the regulation. And they say, based on our quick review of this incredibly complex rule, it does not accomplish this. So we have a 60-day implementation period and a compliance period, but it looks like perhaps we're going to have some other challenges and changes, or at least the FDA is going to have some challenges before this goes much further.
I'm a little bit reticent to characterize FMI's statement, but sounds like fighting words to me.
It sounds like fighting words to me.
I'll bet they have a lawyer or two to back that up.
They might.
They might.
They may. But that's on their website. You can read the entire statement instead of, you know, listening to our taking it a little bit out of context by reading a couple of lines. But you should read their entire statement.
Yeah, and we've read statements from IFPA, from International Fresh Produce Association, and others. And it doesn't. I've not heard that type of sentiment before. Actually, some of the statements that I read were, and I'm really paraphrasing, were, you know, they felt like they'd been heard. The produce industry felt like their comments were taken into account. And so it seemed like everybody was in. But some of those statements were made too by Ed Tracy from IFPA, who's going to be on our webinar, and also GS1 again. But these are stakeholders that FDA helped, you know, bring into the fold for us to discuss this on the webinar. So we're all really looking forward to digging in and seeing where we get.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep an eye on this, all the developments associated with this. And of course, we'll be looking forward to some, at least baseline clarification about the rule from FDA on our upcoming webinar. So stay tuned for that. So we also have some new data to share with you from the Interagency Food Safety Analytics Collaboration, or IFSAC, which comprises FDA, CDC, and the USDA's FSIS. So IFSAC recently released a report on food source attribution for 2020 for outbreaks involving Salmonella, E. coli, and Listeria monocytogenes. Now, to get the data for 2020, IFSAC used an estimation method that incorporates outbreak data from 1998 through 2020 with heavy reliance on data from 2016 and later. Now, what's interesting about the 2020 report versus previous years is that IFSAC decided not to include Campylobacter attributions because evidence suggests that the food sources of Campylobacter outbreaks likely differ considerably from the sources of non-outbreak illnesses caused by the pathogen. So for that reason, IFSAC is looking into alternative ways to estimate sources of Campylobacter illnesses. Now, this recent report looked at 1,287 outbreaks, with 960 of these being linked to Salmonella, 272 to E. coli, and 55 to Listeria. Now, the findings showed that more than 3/4 of the Salmonella illnesses were linked to 7 food categories, including chicken, fruits, pork, seeded vegetables, other produce, beef, and turkey. Now, for E. coli, more than 80% of the illnesses were linked to raw vegetables, while for Listeria, more than 75% of the illnesses were attributed to dairy products, fruits, and vegetable row crops. However, IFSAC noted that the rarity of Listeria outbreaks makes estimates for the pathogen a little bit less reliable than for Salmonella or E. coli.
Well, and coming in at 74% of the illnesses, we understand why legislation is unfolding around Salmonella. Yeah. One of the first things I said when we were having our production meeting to Bob was, well, I mean, 2020 is 2 years ago. You have to wait 2 years to get information. Is it useful? And I'm going to ask Bob to, you know, restate his reply to me because it was very informative. And I think you could probably help some of you understand as well, those who may not know as much as others.
It may have taken long to get the information, the data that they needed for 2020, but they also make a point in the report that 2020 and 21 were unusual years.
Was there something going on then?
There was something happening, I remember.
Between binging Netflix.
And not seeing the outside
yeah.
at all. Yeah. But they do mention that there was a reduction in the reporting of some of these outbreaks, and they suspect it was because people didn't want to go to the hospital, didn't want to report things, they weren't going to restaurants, all these other factors that have little to do with the causes of them, or at least those causes of them. But in the 2020 data, that number 75% came up a couple of times. What they essentially did was an 80-20 analysis of how many types of foods accounted for 75 or 80% of the outbreaks. And it's interesting to see that Salmonella is only 7 foods. Adrian listed them. E. coli is essentially 2. And the one thing between Salmonella and E. coli is the largest one in Salmonella was under 20% of the outbreaks, but the largest one in E. coli was almost 60% of the outbreaks, which is the leafy greens. And so if you look at those and then say 3 for Listeria, you now have a pretty good focus on if you want to reduce these type of outbreaks. You've got 7 foods in Salmonella, you've got 1 or 2 in E. coli, and you've got a couple in Listeria where are your targets. The other interesting thing is Campylobacter, the reason why they didn't look into it further is almost 100% of the cases were from products using unpasteurized milk, which was not widely used. It's used in a few communities. And so it's not something that they wanted to look at in the same way. But they also look back at the data to trend it, but they reduced the weighting of anything before 2020 so that you could see a trend. It wasn't just a year's impact that might have been sporadic, but you can see what it looks like over time, and that was pretty consistent. So this data to me is fascinating. If you want to know why the USDA is looking at Salmonella and chicken, it was the number one target. So if you're going to go after reducing illnesses, you now have clear targets.
So Bob, also when we were speaking about this earlier, you were making a comment about the percentage of Listeria or L. mono being low. But, you know, some insight into that. Could you share that with the audience?
Yeah, we've talked about this in a previous pod when we go over some of these some of this data, that even though Salmonella is more frequent than Listeria, and they show the same thing here in this data, Listeria is a much more dangerous foodborne illness with more fatalities. And if I remember the data right, even though Salmonella outweighs Listeria in the number of outbreaks, when you look at fatalities, it's actually close to the same number. So there is an issue of severity that's not dealt with here. That wasn't their job in this study, but you do have to remember that, you know, that the number of people affected and the number of people, you know, number of fatalities are roughly the same between those two pathogens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that's actually kind of a good segue into another thing we want to mention is that Maple Leaf Foods recently held its 12th annual Food Safety Symposium in partnership with the North American Meat Institute on October 24th. Now, Maple Leaf holds this symposium every year to mark its commitment to food safety and to facilitate information sharing and collaboration among the food industry. Now, this year's theme for the symposium was how measurement, management, and transparency builds long-term trust among stakeholders. Now, aside from serving as a commemorative event to reinforce the memory of the 22 lives lost in the 2008 Listeria outbreak tragedy, and to reinforce Maple Leaf's commitment to food safety as the company's highest priority, the symposium also provides a place for food safety experts to discuss pressing issues. Now, this year, several experts shared their thoughts on the industry's non-competitive approach to creating best practices and workshops for Listeria control, and how collaborative efforts create value and trust. Another panel of experts discussed the value of food safety audits in encouraging transparency and continuous improvement. And specifically, they pointed out that how a company responds to audit results can be more important than the audit itself.
I love this focus on the non-competitive approach. And if I can show my age for a second, back in the 1970s, there was a Volvo commercial where they talked about inventing the seatbelt, but they didn't patent it. And they made it available to every other car company because they thought that it was far too important to keep it for themselves and that every car should be equipped with a safety belt. The idea that this is the same thing in food safety just makes 100% sense also. I think this is great to see.
Yeah, and I'm glad that we're highlighting this because it's important that what Maple Leaf is doing from a culture standpoint, like how important this event was to them and what it has meant to their company, and as a mark, too, of sustainability for their culture. This is one of the things that they do to sustain the culture at Maple Leaf is not forgetting and always remembering what happened and their company's commitment to making sure that it doesn't happen again. One of the most important podcasts that we've put out over our almost 5 years now, I guess 4.5 years to be exact, was episode number 33, where we had the Maple Leaf CEO, Michael McCain, and Randy Huffman, a member of our editorial advisory board, thank you, Randy, come on and discuss their approach. You know, the name of the title of the episode is Food Safety After Tragedy. I would suggest if you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to episode 33. It's very important. Michael McCain also said too, like Dave Thino, if you're having an issue with your CEO, you're not feeling like you're getting traction, call me. You know, I want to be a resource. And so I think that the leadership team at Maple Leaf feels that way across the board. Anyway, so grateful to be able to highlight this again and bring everybody's awareness of how people are creating and maintaining food safety culture, even after, you know, terrible tragedies that were suffered after that outbreak. Okay, so as always, there are links in the show notes to all the stories and articles that we've mentioned. We also want to remind you to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Just search for Food Safety Magazine. And if you want to take a deeper dive into all the great content we offer or register for that traceability webinar, visit our website, food-safety.com. And now it's time for the interview. So let me tell you a little bit about our guests. Dr. Vanessa Kaufman is the director of the Alliance to Stop Foodborne Illness. She comes to Stop Foodborne Illness with a diverse background in food safety and sustainability, with a focus on environmental exposures across the food system. She received her PhD in environmental epidemiology from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and an MS degree from the University of California, Berkeley in Global Public Health and the Environment. Sherry Bryce Williamson is Vice President of Global Food Safety and Quality at the Kellogg Company, where she oversees end-to-end food safety and quality for Kellogg's internal and external network. Sherry has over 20 years of experience in the industry and has served in numerous supply chain roles in the company, ranging from operations to quality. Sherry holds a bachelor's and master's degree in business management. Megan Kanjora is the Senior Manager of Food Safety Culture at the Hershey Company, where she leads a diverse global team to embed food safety in the hearts and minds of all Hershey employees. Megan has extensive experience building relationships among diverse groups, getting cross-functional support, and effectively communicating messages across cultures. Megan is an MBA candidate at the University of North Carolina Business School, and she holds an MPA from Penn State University, BA degrees in political science, and classics from Bucknell University. All right, let's get right to it.
So I am here today with Dr. Vanessa Kaufman, the director of the Alliance to Stop Foodborne Illness. I'm also here with Sherry Williamson, the Vice President of Global Quality and Food Safety at the Kellogg Company, and Megan Kanjora, the Senior Manager of Food Safety Culture at the Hershey Company. Well, thank you so much for being here today, ladies.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk to the three of you today. Now, Vanessa, I want to start off this interview with a question for you about your work. Now, you're the director of the Alliance to Stop Foodborne Illness, and I'm curious, you do so much good work. What drives your desire to build partnerships with food companies to help them support strong food safety cultures and, you know, also help them understand the personal impacts of food safety on public health? And, you know, how do you work to achieve these goals in your role?
Well, Adrienne, thank you so much for having me. And it's so great to be surrounded by all these strong women here in food safety today. Before I get to your first question, I'd like to say a little bit about STOP, the organization, just so folks have a little idea of what I'm involved in and what Megan and Sherry are also getting themselves into. So STOP was founded in 1993 after an E. coli outbreak on the West Coast that killed some of the children of the mothers and fathers who founded the organization, and rightfully so, they were pretty mad that their babies had died. So they came together and formed a really strong group who advocated for policy change. And in 2018, the idea of the Alliance came to be, and the organization or the program of the organization has really blossomed since then. We have about 20 members now, and a lot of them are large multinational companies, but we have people from farm to fork who are involved in the food system and who really care about food safety culture and want to improve not only their internal food safety culture, but that for all of their suppliers and people throughout the food system who also have a huge role to play in protecting consumers. This is actually the second time I'm working for the organization, and I just see food safety culture as an amazing vehicle for changing things positively for consumers. And, you know, collectively, when we have all these great companies together, they can achieve so much. So it's really a special place. And we have quite a few activities going on. Megan and Sherry are both involved in a food safety culture toolkit that we've recently published. And it's aimed for small and medium-sized companies who can help advance their food safety culture and progress down their journey of improving their food safety culture.
Wow, okay, that's really interesting. So, Megan, I have a question next for you. So, I know that you serve on the Alliance Planning Committee, and I'm curious, you know, what kind of skills do you bring from your role as senior manager of food safety culture at Hershey to the Alliance? And then also, you know, what kind of knowledge or tools do you bring back to Hershey from your work with the Alliance?
So I bring a pretty deep knowledge of Hershey's experience building our culture, as well as industry engagement across different organizations to the Alliance. So my experience leading Hershey's culture journey is pretty unique in that culture is my main job function. So we've been really focused on improving since I joined the company 8 years ago. And we were lucky enough to start from a place of strength. So we did not have a burning platform or a major incident that caused this area to be focused on. So we really are able to bring that perspective of being proactive and starting this journey from a place where you can just improve versus needing to kind of rebuild, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Also through this role, I bring the unique needs of not only the Hershey Company itself, but of our consumers, our suppliers, our partners, as well as our customers. So many of those stakeholders fall into the small and medium-sized businesses that the Alliance is really building tools to help. So my work experience with them has really helped to inform the things that we should be focusing on as an Alliance group. So the second piece to that was the industry engagement. I was part of the technical working group that wrote the position paper on food safety culture, and I served as the inaugural chair of the IAFP Professional Development Group. So I have a lot of really great experiences and a pretty deep network of people who are passionate about food safety culture across the food industry and beyond. So from this experience, I'm able to bring back to Hershey a lot of best demonstrated practices really from our partners as well as other Alliance members. And I'm able to incorporate those into our own journey. And the toolkit itself and other working on are very useful for our suppliers and our partners.
That's fantastic. And, you know, especially, you know, as you stated, coming from a place of having a strong food safety culture already in place, and then being able to bring back, you know, these additional tools and skills and make it, you know, further robust at your company. I mean, that's amazing. That's really, really cool to hear. So, Sherry, my next question is for you. How have you helped facilitate Kellogg's membership in the Alliance to Stop Foodborne Illness? And, you know, what benefits have you observed to the company and your work from participating in it?
Great question. First, thank you for having me. I'm very excited about the podcast today and just look forward to just connecting and communicating with the team here. So first, looking at STOP and the Alliance, one of the things is the work that they're working on is really in line with the master plan that we established for QFS for Kellogg. So my leadership team and I actually do a strategic planning session every year. And a lot of the work, for instance, the gamification work, the video series, the recall modernization work stream, also the toolkit for, you know, overall culture, food safety culture, all of those things were in line with some of the things that actually was on our master plan around tactics that we had to deliver. So we've partnered with STOP already on one video, which is actually going into a series. We actually are working on our second video. And the benefits is really around helping our people and getting really at the hearts and minds of our people, right? So we want people to believe in what they do and how they impact every day the work that goes on here at Kellogg. So I think STOP has been instrumental in that. So working with Vanessa and the team there at STOP has really helped us to form our strategies for the year around food safety culture. And we've actually been learning from each other, but also helping us improve even how we're going about truly driving a sustainable food safety culture. The word sustainable is really key. We had a great master plan before, but I think STOP has actually helped inform our master plan even more through the video series, us doing gamification, looking at that work stream, and then the recall modernization work mm-hmm. stream.
That's fantastic, you know, like using, utilizing all these different modes of learning and communication and teaching, and then, you know, also that STOP's able to help you with, you know, your planning around food safety culture. I mean, that's fantastic to hear. Now, Vanessa, my next question is for you. Now, we've already discussed a little bit about the Food Safety Culture Toolkit, which is just one of the tools that the Alliance offers for food companies. And I know that this toolkit is tailored, as you said, for medium-sized and small companies. Can you give us an overview of the resources available within this toolkit and how they can be used?
Sure, absolutely. I love promoting the toolkit. It's one of my favorite things that we've been doing with the Alliance. So the toolkit offers a lot of resources for small and medium-sized companies who are looking to improve their food safety culture journey. And currently we have some videos available. So like Sherry was mentioning, Kellogg's has made a video for their internal food safety culture program utilizing one of our stop constituents. And other companies have done those as well. And I think they're really powerful as you watch them and you can, you know, show them to your employees. And it really touches the heart along with the mind when you're thinking about how food safety and food safety culture are really important. We also have some key questions and thoughts to be considering as you develop your food safety culture plan. And some of the things that we're adding to the toolkit include roadmaps for to show how other companies have kind of improved their food safety culture, and then a playbook for rewards and recognition, which is the topic of our next co-sponsored FDA or FDA co-sponsored webinar. So it's number 5 in a series of 10 that the Alliance has been putting on quarterly with the FDA. And we're really excited to be talking about rewards and recognition this time.
That's fantastic. So the toolkit sounds pretty comprehensive, and it sounds like there's going to be a lot of things added too.
That's the goal. That's the hope. So we've launched on World Food Safety Day this year, and we're just hoping to keep adding and improving and getting feedback from people who are using it so that we can make it the most useful that it can be for folks.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, looking at the different resources that the Alliance offers, or that there's kind of a sneak preview of what's coming on the webpage. What other resources are you working to build for food companies and Alliance members?
So the Alliance is a really cool place because it's really driven by the members and how they would like to go and what resources they would like to have and how they can use their collective power to better the food system and food safety culture within the food system. So, you know, the possibilities are really endless. I tell people that all the time. For example, you know, I wouldn't have thought that recall modernization would be on the table, but collectively, the Alliance members decided that that was something they were really passionate about mm-hmm. and that they could do something about. So the recall system in the U.S. is not functioning as well as it could be. And that is for a variety of reasons that we can get into maybe on another podcast. It boils down to consumers not getting the information that they need. And, you know, these companies want to get the information out to consumers. So we're working together with all of the members and some subject matter experts to see how we can make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. Now, Sherry and Megan, I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, how you're utilizing these resources from the Alliance at your own companies, and also the relationships that you've found through being Alliance members. You know, just maybe Sherry, you can go first, and then Megan, talk a little bit about, well, Sherry, you talked a little bit about already about how you're utilizing that food safety toolkit at Kellogg. But, you know, maybe talk a little bit more about, you know, do you think that working with the Alliance helps facilitate discussions among industry to improve best practices? You know, maybe you can share any examples of that or of the relationships that have been fostered by your membership within the Alliance.
Great question. And first, I would really like to say one of the good things about STOP and being part of the Alliance is that you're able to bring the outside in. So if you think about it, it's not just about Kellogg. It's about the membership coming together to look at the tools, the best practices, so you can learn from each other. But also, you have a chance to actually engage so that we can truly look at what is the best thing for the industry, because that's really what we're about, right? So food safety to me is not a competitive advantage. It is something that our consumers expect. And when you actually interact with the constituents from STOP, I've actually been able to interact now with two of them. They really send the message that as a consumer, we want safe food. It is non-negotiable. So how we actually partner with Alliance and understand from each other on how do we bring the best practices into different companies is really key. So like, for instance, the video series that we're doing now really takes it home for me, because you have a woman that was impacted by a foodborne illness and actually lost her baby. So Anne Marie is her name. And you think about that story, that's compelling, that a person ate something that a manufacturing facility made and actually got sick, and it led to a miscarriage. That's significant. So really getting those inputs and actually then us in Kellogg taking it and transforming it into something that our people can actually internalize. And then it also helps with change in behavior. And that's how you truly build sustainability. So I think some of the tools from the toolkit, from the video series, even thinking about how we leverage gamification differently so that we can build capability in a different way within the facility, has been great resources for us to partner on. And it's really been a partnership. It's not about Kellogg Alliance or Hershey. It's about us coming together to say, how do we together make the industry better and make the consumer base better?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you talked about, you know, sharing personal stories as a way of, you know, helping communicate that message and helping people understand, you know, the impact that their work does. And I mean, if you read, you know, this Stop Foodborne Illness has a lot of personal stories that people have shared publicly of their experiences with foodborne illness. And, you know, some of those stories are of survivors, and unfortunately, mm-hmm. some of them are of people who lost family members. If you read those stories, you know, I think for anybody that works in the food industry or food service industry, that should be, you know, these should be required reading. I mean, that really drives home the point of why do you do what you do in the careful way that you do? You know, why do you do food safety? Why is that always at the forefront of everything you do? So absolutely, you're right. You know, like that's always important to keep, you know, that kind of messaging in mind, because it helps you, you know, remember the why behind what you're doing. So
I also think that it's important for our people at the front line through every level of the organization, mm-hmm. understand why what they do is important. Mm-hmm. And it's critical that they get it right the first time, because we don't have a second time to get it right. So I think the videos are critical. And then the gamification helps to build capability in a different way. So it brings it home. Everybody's into games now. So that's why that work stream really makes me excited, because if you think about it, if you can figure out, I call it the secret sauce of driving sustainable culture within your facilities, that is what saves lives. It's all about that sustainability and truly getting at the hearts and minds. Because if you get at the hearts and minds of your people, you can change. You can make significant change. And I think STOP helps us to do that. And it's that partnership is appreciative to me. It helps me to integrate, you know, the things that they're taking into our master plan. And it has been a win-win for me and for Kellogg and for, I think, for STOP and the other membership.
Mm-hmm. That's so great to hear. Now, Megan, what about you? You know, how at Hershey have you utilized the resources from Alliance and the relationships that you've built? And, you know, do you think that that helps facilitate discussion on best practices among industry?
Yeah, thanks, Adrian. That was a great question. And thank you, Sherry, for bringing up all of those amazing points. I don't even know I need to say anything. You kind of had a mic drop there. but I 100% agree with Sherry that sustainability is really number one in our world as well. If you do this really well for a few months and then it falls off the radar, that's not really work well done, right? You need to keep it fresh and really keep everything top of mind for folks across your company around the world, depending on where they are. So one of the things that I thought would be a great illustration of how kind of the discussions that we have in the Alliance meetings, and this one comes specifically from the toolkit, because that's my favorite, like Vanessa said, the toolkit group has been my favorite so far. Maybe it's just because we've been doing it the longest, but I was working with another toolkit member, an Alliance member, to talk about one of the things we were working on offline, about two BDPs that we were sharing from our companies. And we realized that the two things that we were doing actually were complementary and would help both of our companies if we did a version of that, right? That would be able to be, you know, a Hershey version and then the other company version. And it really helped us improve both of our journeys, as well as kind of strengthen the overall tool for the toolkit, as well as the follow-on discussions that we had during the meetings that came after that discussion. So it's really just these little microcosms of, you know, discussion, and then it turns into this kind of bigger thing. And I think bringing these folks together is something that is one of my favorite parts of the Alliance. I'm a people person. I love learning new things from everyone, and the Kellogg's video and other Alliance member videos that have been shared on our industry calls have been just absolutely life-changing. And that's really what we use at Hershey, is really those experiences of people, because I don't think that a lot of food industry employees really understand that why of, you know, washing your hands. Yeah, it's important, whatever, I'll do it. I do it well, blah, blah, blah. But like that really can impact someone's entire lifetime. And one of the biggest things that I like to use the stop videos for is to show that, you know, foodborne illness isn't just getting sick and going to work 2 days later. It can have a lifelong impact. And working with the Alliance really helps to tell that part of the story that I don't think gets enough publicity in any part of the world, right? Like, you know that there's people, you see numbers of folks who may have been fatally impacted by a recall, or you have, you know, the people who just get a little bit sick, like food poisoning, and then are back on with their lives. But it's that middle group of lives that are changed forever that helps to give the voice to. And what we like to use at Hershey are those types of videos with our employees and our leaders to understand, hey, this is real, and this is the power that you have through doing your job. It's to protect all of these people out here. And that helps to connect those dots.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, that's great. And, you know, when you were talking about, you know, the work you were doing where you realized that, you know, you had something that was applicable to Hershey and then to the other company that you're working with. That's a great example of collaboration. I think it's also an example, you know, in that particular instance of, you know, food safety not being competitive. So that's fantastic.
It's how we learn together. I just wanted to just echo what Megan said. Mm-hmm. I think when we bring two different companies together and we can create something even more impactful, that's the secret sauce right there, because you're taking two different companies coming together and making something more impactful that both companies and more companies can use to even make us better. Mm-hmm. And to get to the place of making sure our consumers get what they expect every day, and that's safe food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Now, we know that creating and maintaining a successful food safety culture requires clear, ongoing communication, you know, about expected behaviors and practices from management. Now, along this line of thinking, I'd like to first ask Vanessa, so in your work with Alliance members, what are some of the common areas for improvement that you have seen in food safety communication?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. So first, I'd like to mention that the example that Megan shared is something that I talk about all the time with people when I'm trying to talk about how great the Alliance is and what can be done, because, you know, the sharing of information is so critical, and it's critical among people, among peers, so that we can get it right. And it not being a competitive advantage is so very important. And it's so wonderful when we can share this information with people who are in different parts of the food system. So the company that Megan was referencing sharing information with was not a chocolatier or in the candy industry at all. So it's so cool to see people collaborate from different spheres. Having a really strong food safety culture does begin at the top. Obviously, you have to have people bought in at the bottom, who are the frontline hourly employees, but having communication come from upper management is so very critical. You need to have people who are bought in, who are doing the right thing, who are walking the talk, and having our Alliance members, you know, it's really hard because a lot of the Alliance members, actually every single one of them, I believe, come with a pretty strong food safety culture already, mm-hmm. A really good idea of what a food safety culture is or should be. And, you know, if they're not where they want to be, they're working really hard to get there. So having communication amongst the Alliance members and talking about like their communication style, you know, we're working with the cream of the crop here. It's the folks who aren't involved in the Alliance or maybe don't know what food safety culture even is that are a little more concerning. So that's where the food safety culture toolkit that we have online mm-hmm. really comes into play, because, you know, we want to share these best practices from these large companies who have dedicated folks working on food safety culture with companies that don't have the resources or mm-hmm. manpower to be able to do that.
And, you know, just I'm kind of curious. So with some of these companies that you think, you know, well, they really ought to be using this resource because they probably need it. How are you trying to get the resource in the hands of, you know, those companies? Like, how are you promoting the toolkit to companies that you think, you know, like we really want to get this to them, so to help them? Is there anything special that you're doing aside from, you know, like how you're promoting it already?
Well, doing things like this podcast, I hope will help.
Right.
No, I mean, we've been pushing it out on social media as best we can. Anytime there's an opportunity to talk about it during an event or have an Alliance member promote it, you know, we're definitely pushing for that. So I'm hoping it's word of mouth. Mm-hmm. We haven't done any like big PR anything. But I will say that it is free and it's online. So anybody who wants to use it can. And if you're finding it useful, share it with your networks. Go ahead and pass it along to anybody that you think it might be good for. And we'll just keep promoting it and talking about it. And I hope you do too.
Yeah, great. No, absolutely. And, you know, when you first released it, I remember seeing several announcements about it. So the word is definitely getting out there. And I remember we published an article on Food Safety Magazine, our news site, I think the day came out. So definitely getting the message out there. And my last question, kind of along this thread we've been talking about with communication, is to Megan and Sherry. And well, I'll ask Megan first. What are some of the ways that you've established successful communication practices in your organization to encourage a robust food safety culture?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And as our journey continues to evolve, as do our communications. So what we've been doing that has been really probably the most impactful has been these quarterly meetings where our leaders in food safety and quality go out every quarter and meet with all of our executives from across the company. And they're able to do a little bit of training. They're able to give that messaging. We open every meeting with the number of recalls around the world for that month. And it is a staggering number that is still happening today, and it never goes down. Sometimes it'll go down a few, but then the next month it's right back up. So it shows that this is, you know, no matter how much we're doing, this is still not fixed. And we can be able to prevent this only by being proactive and being able to work together with all different areas of the company. And it's not just the food safety and quality technical folks who own this. It's really everyone in the company. And it is not a competitive advantage at Hershey. We've been out here really sharing since the beginning of our journey through all of these different organizations and through informal benchmarking. And so outside of the company, that's one way that we're able to help get the message out and communicate, but also bringing those messages from the Alliance, those stories from constituents to our leaders across the company at all levels, like from the CEO down through all of our vice president levels and beyond, is pretty powerful. It's leaders to leaders. It's telling them clearly, like, here's what your role is and the role of your people. And we're able to mobilize everyone across the company through those meetings to really own it and live it, which is our tagline, right? You need to understand your role, and then you need to execute that role related to food safety. And there's always a call to action at the end that's tied in with our corporate behaviors as well as our leadership behaviors for the company related to food safety as well as that area of the business. So that's how we've been very clear and intentional with our senior leaders. And then down through our plant employees, our hourly folks out on the floor, they're able to get our communications through. We work within our lean quality pillar, so we have that type of methodology across our company, and we're able to get messages out to every manufacturing facility throughout the world in a very uniform way through utilizing that organizational structure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. Okay, and Sherry, and what are some of the ways that you've established good communication practices to encourage robust food safety culture in your organization?
Yes, I love what Megan said, so well done, Hershey. One of the things that we are trying to do and we have already started is really making sure our board of directors understand where we're at from a food safety perspective and what help looks like. So I have meetings with the board. I actually just had one in in July. We also have EXCO meetings, so our executive committee. I will do an update with them on where we're at on food safety culture, what do we need. Steve actually was on the first video. Steve is our CEO. He was actually on the first video that we did with STOP. And then we have some additional leaders, our Latin America president and our supply chain global president, vice president, is on those videos. So we try to make sure when we're communicating, we have the top, because again, food safety does start at the top. And it's important for every part of the organization to understand what's important to our board of directors and our ZETCO. So try to make sure that they are present and engaged in a discussion. So like our mantra is, I own it every day. And I think that's important, especially as we're communicating and making sure people are, because you think about the mantra. The mantra is all about making sure every part of the organization understands how we feel about food safety, right? It helps us to ingrain it in the culture and making sure people understand I own it every day, no matter what part of the organization you're in, is really impactful. So I would want to add that. We also have town halls. And the town halls are with the broader organization. We have also food safety like 101 for the commercial team, because I think it's important that we actually have end-to-end understanding of food safety, no matter if you're at the front line or you're on a commercial team. So we try to make sure we have those type of interactions to drive the why we do what we do, especially when you think about innovation and just running a business. Making sure everybody at every level of the organization understand why we make the decisions we make and how it impacts just the overall business is important. So we try to do that through those town halls and those food safety one-on-one sessions to continue to make sure that we're educating people on where we're at, but also where we're going and helping to bring them along on the journey.
Well, that's great. So wonderful perspectives, and thank you for sharing all that great information about Hershey, Megan, and Kellogg, Sherry, and Vanessa, the Alliance to Stop Foodborne Illness. And I want to thank the three of you for being on the podcast today. And I also want to thank the three of you for doing what you do to promote food safety leadership and to stop foodborne illness. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Vanessa Kaufman, Sherry Bryce Williamson, and Megan Kanjora for joining us on the podcast today. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. Please don't hesitate to send us your questions or suggestions to podcast@food-safety.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. We're always grateful to get your feedback. And I know you want to make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your podcast player. So all you have to do is click that follow or subscribe button in the player of your choice, and presto, that's it. Just one click. There you go. And while you're there, please throw some stars our way by rating the podcast, especially if you liked it. It only takes a moment, and it's good for everyone. That's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on December 8th. In the meantime, take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.